reach the Outrider Podcast.
All right. Hello. Welcome to episode 11 of the Outrider Podcast. A few things to get out of the way first before I tell you about Eric Barnes. The Outrider Podcast is going to go on a brief hiatus until March 24th. There have been some upheavals in my life, and while I make that transition, I'm going to take a little break from the podcast so that I can get moved into a new apartment and get my life settled again. So there will be no episode on February 24th, and no episode on March 10th while I get myself situated. I've got an apartment lined up, just waiting for the application and everything to go through, and I'll get moved in there, I hope, at the beginning of March. And somewhere in all of that, I'll record something with at least one person to be ready for the 24th of March. So be back on March 24th, and we'll talk to somebody new. I don't know who yet. All right, so let's get to Eric Barnes and my conversation with him. Eric is the author of the novel Shimmer from Unbridled Books, and a new novel published in 2013 called Something Pretty, Something Beautiful from Outpost 19. I'm in the middle of reading that one, and I just couldn't wait to talk to Eric, so I got him on the phone and had a good time. I had read his novel Shimmer, which was fabulous, so you should get out there and check that one out. Eric is the publisher of the Daily News, the Memphis News, and the Nashville Ledger, and he's also the host of Behind the Headlines on WKNO. That's the PBS channel out of Tennessee there. So he does a lot of interesting work, and we had, I think, a pretty fabulous conversation. I was glad to finally get the chance to talk to him. We had been, you know, passing emails ever since our books were published, which is kind of how I've gotten to know a lot of writers in the last few years. So let's get right to my conversation with Eric Barnes and have a good time. Thanks.
Hey.
Hello, Eric.
Hey, man. How are you?
Not too shabby. How are you?
I'm great.
Is this the middle of the workday for you?
Yeah.
Ah, excellent. So we only have about that hour then, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm flexible, okay. Actually. So, yeah.
All right. Well, it's nice to finally see you in person.
Yeah.
Having read the first book and started on the second one, which is why... finally, which is what prompted me to give you a call.
Thank you.
Have you had a chance to listen to any of the other shows that I've done? Or
I didn't, which was really just stupid on my
part. No, that's all right.
It was no good reason. I just realized that a minute ago. I was like, what's wrong with me?
That's okay. It's just a very loose format, conversational type of thing. I don't really prepare any questions because I don't usually know the people that I'm talking to. So it's good to figure out who they are, which is, I think, a much more interesting conversation than me pretending that I know a whole bunch of shit.
That's fine.
So I always like to start with an origin story. So where are you from originally?
I grew up in Tacoma, Washington, which is where the second book is set, and lived there and spent a lot of time in Alaska. My father lived up in Alaska in Juneau all through my childhood. Lived in California for a couple of years, Northern California. And then so pretty much the Northwest, mostly Tacoma until I was 18, and then got the heck out of there.
So were you running around Tacoma and Seattle when the Green River Killer was at his height?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was sort of strange, you know. I mean, you just had this notion that I didn't exactly know where Green River was, but it sounded like this really scary place. And but then as you got to be a teenager, you kind of joke about it in that sort of sick way, you know, that you just didn't really understand how serious a thing it was. And then also the fact that Ted Bundy's from Tacoma.
And oh, wow.
He grew up like in my neighborhood, basically. I mean, you know, way, and my brother knew his brother, and it was really strange. I mean, the strange serial murder connection to the Northwest. It's because it rains so much.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's this depression associated with constant. I mean, really, it's strange. Anyway.
Yeah, the closest brush I think I got with serial killer fame was my family was living here in Wichita right about the time when BTK had his first kill, and then we moved off to Dodge City.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, well, you know, the other connection to killers, I mean, this is horrible, but is the DC sniper, the older guy who kind of looked in the younger guy, he was based – and Tacoma has a huge military base and presence. And when they identified who it was, they had this helicopter circling over this neighborhood in Tacoma. My brother, who also grew up in Tacoma, called me and said, "Are you watching this? It's Tacoma. The guy's from Tacoma." So, it's disturbing.
Yeah, it is. It took a weird turn. I was kind of sort of talked about this with Darren Dufresne, who wrote the Salt Palace. We were kind of went on a spree with serial killers, which seems to be a strange topic right now for me. I don't know what it is.
Writing about serial killers, or are you maybe you're wanting to write about serial killers?
No, I think it's just it seems to be creeping up lately. It's like a synchronous type of thing.
Yeah.
There was a guy whose father was the lead investigator on the Green River investigation who wrote a graphic novel recently about his father and that investigation.
Oh, really?
Huh. It was a fascinating, amazing book. It actually turned out to be more about the father-son relationship and how that was affected by the investigation.
Right.
More than it was really about the investigation.
Yeah.
So it was really kind of a fascinating book. I think it's just called Green River.
Uh-huh.
So you were in Tacoma until you were 18.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then back and forth to Alaska and
spent summers up there for quite a while. My dad lived up there for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. So and, you know, sort of an old school divorce. So I'd go up for parts of the summers and Christmas breaks and that kind of thing. And Juneau is really dark and really you know, it's basically a temperate rainforest. You know, it's not sort of snow and ice. There's a lot of snow and ice, but it's mostly just dark and rainy. And so I think, you know, particularly this last book, that sort of constant claustrophobic rain feel is partly Tacoma, but it's as much Juneau on some level as it was Tacoma. And then I worked out in the fish processing plant thing for two or three summers. So I lived in a tent out on the Kenai Peninsula, a couple hours outside Anchorage in the summer, which the summers are really beautiful up there. And that was, you know, and there's a little of that in the book. Mm-hmm. I've written short stories about that as well.
Don't spoil the book for me.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard... Well, I haven't really heard anything firsthand or too specific, but can you make good money in the summer in the fish factories there, or is that just kind of?
Yeah, you can, mostly because you work so many hours. I mean, I would work, you know, you'd work 80 hours a week for 6 weeks, and you know, you just kind of, and so it was, and you start making overtime, and so I don't, you know, if I was 18, 19, 20, I'd make, you know. You know, I don't know, and that's those summers where I make $3,000-$5,000 or something. I can't quite remember, but it was a lot for a, you know, it felt like a lot at the time.
Right.
I don't know what it's like now, but it's more, again, it's not that it pays so much, it's just that they work you to death and you take all this over. Because once the season opens and the fish start running, they just got to keep processing fish as fast as they possibly can. So they have all these exceptions to the, you know, the labor laws and the child labor laws and all that kind of thing, you know, to make sure that, they keep the wheels in motion. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of work did your father do up there?
He was essentially a superintendent, a regional superintendent. And he'd always been in, until he retired, into education. He was a teacher, a principal, superintendent, and a regional superintendent. And So, and Alaska was this great place to be at the time because they had so much oil money. I mean, you could go up there. Right. If you had an idea, you could get a grant. That's how he ended up there. They were willing to experiment or do anything in public education because they had so much money to spend. Huh. May still be the case. I'm not sure.
Cool. Did they actually give people, I mean, wives' tales, I guess I've heard, and jokes and things, but they actually paid people to live there?
All that stuff is true. I mean, there's truth to all that. There are a couple different things. One, they pay, back then especially, and I think it's still the case, but back then, they paid really high salaries in all kinds of professions to get people up there because it was so hard. It's still hard to be there, but now you got the internet and it's just a little bit more, you're not quite as isolated. Two, they have all that oil money, the state does, and it kind of filters out, but there's a fair amount of money. And then in some places they would, set up programs. I mean, that was the whole, what was that show called? But the doctor living in Alaska with Northern Exposure. I mean, that was a real program to get doctors and others to come up to Alaska because it was otherwise so unattractive. And right. And then the one that's famous is, they're not famous, but they have this thing called the Permanent Fund, and it was basically a portion of the profit of the big investment fund, the oil-fueled investment fund, they would pay out to every resident. And my brother lived up there a little bit after high, or he lived up there a little while after high school, and he'd get, $1,000 or $2,000 every year. But it's a miserable place to live. I mean, I'm sorry, my brother, people in Alaska, but it's just miserable. So.
But you spent your winters then down in either Washington or California, is that right?
Washington, yeah. I lived for 2 years in California, but for the most part, I was in Tacoma. So, yeah, I mean, and it was just rainy. I mean, it was just rain from, it was just kind of Tacoma's a big blue-collar city that, we sort of, we lived kind of in the middle of all that. And, I went to a big public high school there all that kind of thing. It was a very strange place. I mean, and my experience of it's really weird. I mean, I have a very good friend from high school who still lives in Washington and works in Tacoma. And he talks about how different it is to be there as an adult and that it's changed. And that's true. I mean, so a lot of my vision of that place is, influenced by, of my, I have 10 aunts and uncles, 5 or 6 of them are alcoholics. My cousins were, some of them were great and they all fled. Mm-hmm. Some were just a mess. And so there's a lot of messiness in my family that I associate probably unfairly with Tacoma. Because there are lots of, it's mini hip place to be right now, actually, which I can understand. So.
And I guess a lot of it has to do with just there's one side of the world you see as a child and another side you see as an adult. I grew up out in Dodge City, Kansas, and just early last year ended up going back there because of the job I have now and spend a week there, 4 days. And, I drove by the old house where I grew up and looked at some of the neighborhoods. My grade school had been turned into a Spanish language church.
Yeah.
And I just realized, that for a kid, it was a fine place to grow up because you could walk everywhere, you could hide out in various places, have adventures. But if you're a grown up, that's probably the most dead place on the planet, outside of maybe Alaska.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's funny too. I mean, you talk about that, those kid perspectives I've had, so many people who read the book have said, that reminds me of somebody was talking about Kansas or Missouri where they grew up in this kind of desolate place. And another person was telling me, it reminded me exactly like Orlando, Florida. Mm-hmm. I was like, really? It was, oh, yeah, you forget Disney World and all that. He had grown up in the kind of lost suburban, mass of Orlando. And he said the book was exactly like Orlando. And there've been a few other places like that. So I think there is a sort of, it's an unfair, characterization of Tacoma. It's more of a characterization of suburban lower middle class America, and it right. you know, different shadings. You know, in Florida, it's constantly sunny, relentlessly, I'm sure. And, you know, and people were talking about Memphis. You know, there's some really rough, I love Memphis, but there's some really rough parts. And some friends of mine who grew up here were like, oh, this is just like North Memphis or wherever. No, it's really, I mean, or that's interesting because yeah. I didn't mean it.
Yeah, well, once you get, one of the things I always say about writing is once you get specific, it actually ends up becoming universal because there's a certain shared quality to every experience, yeah. no matter where it's located. That emotional core is the same whether you're in Pittsburgh or Dallas or whatever. You're still a teenager. You're still
right
stuck at court of, you know, more or less to your parents' whims where they decided to. You know, settle themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And you never want to be there.
right. I think you're totally right. And I remember going, I was talking to somebody about this recently, but I remember, I spoke at a book club last week, they were asking me something about Tacoma and all that. And I remember, I'd forgotten all about this, but something they asked reminded me that back when I wrote the original kind of short stories, part of a really bad manuscript, I was in graduate school, and the stuff about the four kids in the book I kind of mm-hmm. pulled out from that mess many years later. But I remember I wasn't calling it Tacoma, and I was talking to one of my professors there, Robert Towers, who was since passed away, but was like this good old New York literary guy. He was originally from Richmond, and I was going on and on about how I didn't know whether I could call this place Tacoma or I was calling it Talcott. I'd made up a name. And he finally just kind of looked at me and was like, I just don't think it makes any difference.
Yeah.
If it's Tacoma, it's Tacoma. And it doesn't have to be 100% accurate. That doesn't matter. You just got to. And I was so hung up on that question. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, could I write this fictionalized, if although based in fact, version of Tacoma? And I was so hung up on that. And I just remember his look when he finally just goes, well, I just stopped. So yeah. I think I went home that night, changed it to Tacoma, and, you know, kind of just went off from there.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the hardest lessons to learn when you're a young writer. It's one that I struggled with and then watched a lot of my grad school friends struggle with, is that they want to pull those early stories out of their life, but they don't know how to separate the fact of what actually happened from that truth of what happened, and that the facts don't matter at all
right.
when you're writing fiction. I mean,
Yeah, right.
They're flexible.
It's how you end up with the classic, really miserable to read workshop story of someone, you know, mm-hmm. someone's memory of their grandfather's funeral, because, you know, it's particularly if you're younger and you're not kind of quite figured out this writing thing. You know, you think, well, I got to write something sad. And the saddest thing I remember is my grandpa's funeral. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing this really sad thing about my grandpa's funeral, but it's kind of forced. And like you're saying, it's probably really accurate.
Right.
And most people, things like that aren't that interesting, you know, and they're really painful for the people involved, but they're not interesting blow by blow kind of stories. And, you know, so that's interesting what you're saying. I mean, it is like you get to that point where you can separate. Once you can separate fact and fiction, mm-hmm. and sort of maybe base things in your experience, but completely fictionalize it. So much so now that like there's certain things I don't remember. I can't sort it out from this book because I wrote these stories over so many years. And there's certain things that I'm not entirely. I mean, I know big things that really didn't happen, but there are certain mm-hmm. little things that I can't quite keep straight anymore because I've lived in stories so much.
So were you always into books and writing, or was there a moment in your youth where it kind of turned on?
I think I was definitely always into books and reading and all that. And then kind of started writing in high school. Mm-hmm. Oh, I started writing for the school newspaper and yearbook, you know, which is, you know, probably a junior high. And then it was, and sort of liked that and got praise for it. And I guess, you know, I haven't really ever thought about that, but yeah, so that's probably how I started. And then, but I, you know, growing up where I grew up, nobody, I didn't know anybody was a writer, you know, mm-hmm. yeah. everybody I knew was a welder, or they worked for an insurance company, or they were a carpenter or they're a dentist. You know, I mean, like my dad, because he was so removed. I mean, it just the realm of professions or things you could pursue was so small. So I got to college and I remember looking at the, printed course catalog. This is how old I am, and there was this writing class. And I thought, I kind of like to go do that. I think I really want to. And I sort of, weaseled my way into it. And that was mind blowing to me that, like, this woman, Blanche McCrary Boyd, was a published writer and she published some books and she wrote for, Rolling Stone and Village Voice and all that. And I was like, wow, you can do that? I mean, I just didn't know you could do that. And, so some people, don't like the whole, writing program deal. And I kind of, for me, it was great. And it was the graduate program because to be around other writers, for me, otherwise, I wouldn't have ever been around other writers. I mean, it was just a way of kind of realizing, hey, you can do something else, something totally different with your life.
Yeah. Sounds a lot like my experience, growing up out in Dodge City and then here in Wichita, I really never knew writers. And then I went off and enrolled at K-State and was doing my orientation and realized I had to take an economics class if I wanted to major in journalism. And I thought, math, and then later on, as if to prove to myself and the cosmos that I really, really sucked at math, I failed the Math for Dummies class that I waited until my senior year to take. So I had to take college algebra.
Oh my gosh.
That was a nail biter. So I flipped open the catalog and saw English creative writing. And I'd been writing short stories since about the sixth grade when a teacher had these weekly worksheets that I would fill out, or the whole class would do, finish this story or start the story that ends this way, and just was addicted to it. I thought, I can major in it. And once I got into my first workshop and met Steve Heller, who now teaches out at Antioch in LA, that was the first real published writer that I had ever met. And if it wasn't for that undergraduate and then my MFA program, I never would have been around writers at all. So yeah, it was definitely worth it. What made you go all the way from the West Coast to California, Seattle to Columbia?
It was as physically far away as I could get. It was, I didn't know what I was doing when I was applying to college. I had no guidance from anyone, really. I just was sort of making it up and, reading, just trying to wing it. And I was one of 650 kids in my senior class, one college counselor, he was like, nice guy. I don't know what he was like, but he's trying to get people in the military or Oak Tech or into state school, all of which is fine. He just didn't have any time for me. So I was actually thinking I was going to go down to, probably to California. And then I think it was my senior year, maybe it was my junior year of high school. My dad took me and my brother to New York City for a week, and it blew my mind. I was just like, oh my God. I mean, this was just, it was the most, the biggest, loudest, most intense place I've ever been. And I realized that I didn't necessarily want to go live there for college, but I wanted to go to the East Coast. I mean, I just sort of realized I really want to do that. And so I sort of shifted gears and went to school in Connecticut and then lived in New York and, then went to graduate school in New York. And that was all great. So like 10, I was in the Northeast for, Connecticut, New York, et cetera, for 10 years. It was great. It was really great to leave, I have to say. But it was really great. I mean, I wouldn't change a thing. I mean, I really enjoyed being there and enjoyed just the intensity of that and enjoyed visiting, now, because you just feel comfortable in the city having lived there. Or even to go to a place like Paris, I don't speak the language. But, it's like, no, I don't know. It's still not as intense as New York, I mean, it's just sort of the thing of, having been there for a while. So, so I left, like back to the Tacoma thing. I mean, I have a visit, fairly regularly, but I haven't lived out there. And it's odd. I mean, I've lived more of my life outside the Northwest than inside the Northwest, really strange because I still think of myself as being a, kind of a Northwesterner.
So Columbia is kind of the old stomping grounds of some of my literary heroes. Allen Ginsberg and Kerouac and Burroughs went there for a while. Were they still kind of a presence there? Or
sort of. Maybe a little bit. I was kind of unaware of that. I mean, in my goofy way. So I don't know that it was a huge presence. It was more what I remember of Columbia just being in New York. I mean, and being, that was more what was going on. And we were kind of crammed into a little building on the side of campus. And you know, one thing about it was there was some history with that program that I didn't realize. And I think maybe it goes back to some of those guys that in the 60s, the School of the Arts and the writing program got real crossways with the administration. And so there was sort of this, lore was that, they had just sort of relegated the writing program into this corner. And, it had taken years for it to kind of come back into the, acceptable mainstream of Columbia life or something. I don't know how true that is. I just like I was saying before, I just like the idea that I was around other writers and, I had really great professors and, it was also, to go back to school and be focused on school, undergraduate, I just did because you were supposed to, and I probably drank too much beer and I really didn't get focused till my junior or senior year, but in graduate school, I was focused the whole time. Really wanted that, enjoyed it, got a lot out of it. So I
might have misunderstood something. You did Columbia as a graduate school. Where was it that you did undergrad?
Connecticut College. So okay. For art school in New London, Connecticut. I mean, it was a fairly random choice. It was good. And there were a lot of good things that came out of that, but it was just, I think back on it. Teenage kids now. My stepson is a senior in the middle of looking at schools, and my son's a sophomore, and we're already looking at schools. And it's such a more systematic, informed, kind of. I'd never visited Connecticut College. I'd never been to Connecticut. I just got off the airplane and was like, "Here I am. I got this bag," and it was just so random. So anyway, it was good. It was good to be. It was a very good school, and the writer in residence there was really good to me and helped on that front.
Who are some of the writers that that you really feel influenced by? Who are your people, your lineage, as I say, would say?
Yeah, I mean, probably the ones that I guess they've influenced me, but I would say I like the most are, Kurt Vonnegut and Cormac McCarthy and Don DeLillo and I read, way too much Hemingway as a teenager. Yeah,
me too.
It's kind of one of those, it's almost, corny to say, but I really did. And I loved it. So those probably for fiction, that was really the people I liked. And that had probably the biggest influence on me. Two books actually that had the single biggest influence on me as a writer in a way were the Raymond Carver short stories.
Oh, yeah.
And then a Richard Ford book of short stories called Rock Springs, which was one of his first books. Because that was – they were writing about the Northwest and the West and the plains, and that blew my mind. I was like, wow, you can write about these things. I sent it to my brother, never wrote, and my brother never went to college, but he's a big reader, and I sent him one of those books. I maybe Cathedral, the collection, the Raymond Carver. No, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. I sent that to him. And I'd never sent a book to my brother before. He was working at construction or something at that time. And he called me, and just was like, I can't even believe this book. because this is our aunt and uncle. This is our cousins. This is exactly what we grew up with. People right. sitting around a kitchen table getting wasted, just talking nonsense and really living nowhere lives. And so to read those books as a writer was probably the most confirming or enlightening thing, to go, oh, wait, these stories, like we were talking about before, you know, these experiences I've had are worthwhile to write right. down, and that to do them in a fictionalized way has, you know, real value. And so I wrote, you know, for a while I wrote short stories, kind of really spare kind of short stories, more like what Something Pretty, the new book, is like. But I always wanted to, but once I started writing, I wanted to write like Don DeLillo. I wanted to write like big postmodern sort of stuff. So Shimmer was more like that. I mean, in the sense that it wasn't as good as the Don DeLillo book, but, you know, it was like the sense of this big, wealthy, almost social commentary.
It was still really good, Eric.
But so that's what, you know what I'm saying? That's what I was. So it's funny because, I mean, I wrote these stories first that turned into this new book that were more in that kind of spare, like, you know, Raymond Carver side of my brain. But then I wrote Shimmer after, even though they got published out of order. So I'm always a little schizophrenic, you know, how do I want to write, you know? I mean, I really am.
That's not a bad place to be. I think writers that aren't flexible with that, you know, can get stuck somewhere and end up, what one of my professors in grad school used to say is eating their own brain. And that really, after a while, becomes uninteresting to the reader.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. You know, whenever I start something, you know, I'm in the middle of writing another book right now, and, you know, I kind of start and I wonder, like, which side is going to take over, you know? Because I always start something thinking I want to write something funny, even Something Pretty. And however far you're into it, it's a relentlessly unfunny book. I mean, it's really not a funny book. I meant to be writing something funny. When I started the original version of that a million years ago, this messy manuscript, I wanted to write something funny. Shimmer was supposed to be an office comedy. Like a version of The Office. I mean, I think I started writing it before The Office came to America, so right. I wasn't stealing it. And it, you know, there's some funny parts in Shimmer, but it's not a funny book. It's really kind of creepy. I mean, and bad book, you know. Someday I'll write a pure funny book. That's my goal, you know. So we'll see.
I sometimes wish I could write funny, but it what comes out of my brain isn't funny most of the time. Although, you know, if I were going to write something funny, it would have to be nonfiction, because, you know, when you live your life and you have experiences like a guy coming into a bookstore that you work at wearing a propeller beanie looking for a book on, and I quote, choo-choo trains. That's how he said it. And at that same bookstore one day, you're shelving books and you hear someone come up behind you and go, can you tell me where the short stories are? And you turn around and it's a little person. You know, I have those experiences, but, you know, it doesn't really translate very well to fiction for me. So
yeah
there you go.
right. Well, you know, another person who does that kind of stuff that you talk about, strange people, it reminds me of Jesus's son. Is that how you say it? Jesus?
Yeah,
the Dennis Johnson.
Right,
that was another one that blew my mind. And, you know, it's kind of uncomfortably funny at various points, but it's mostly really painful. And and you get the sense that he's based a lot of that in real people that he dealt with. And
that's right.
Again, kind of funny, but really not funny. I mean, so anyway.
Now, did you ever get into to Ken Kesey, who did a lot of stuff in the Northwest?
I didn't. And I think that was partly because I really didn't want to read the Northwest, you know? Uh-huh. I mean, right, the Carver stuff, I know I'm being contradictory, but that just was sort of in my face. And it really spoke to me. But I don't know why I didn't read more Ken Kesey. There's another guy, Tom Robbins, who writes about the Northwest. And I never really wanted to read that stuff. And so the Carver and all that was kind of the exception. To my reading, I wanted to read, you know, again, I wanted to be like Don DeLillo. I mean, that's what I wanted to do, is write big, super smart, you know, vaguely or explicitly funny social commentaries. And just kept,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Carver may have set some stuff in the Northwest, but he was so spare that, you know, he might have said Tacoma and it still could have been, you know,
yes,
Raleigh, North Carolina. It's, you know,
that's true. That's
writing about the landscape really wasn't his strong suit, you know. And Kesey did, particularly in Sometimes a Great Notion, was real heavy on the landscape. That was about logging in Oregon, I think, and there's a weird family there, but
yeah. That's great that you brought that up. I really should I should get back into reading some of his stuff. I don't read a lot of fiction is part of my problem. Read just because I don't like, I'm terrible about it, but I mean, I really am because it screws me up when I'm writing. And so I don't read anywhere near enough fiction. I end up reading all this weird, science books of all things. Uh-huh. I mean, there's book, this guy, David Quammen, who is a great journalist, science writer. He's written for Men's Life and Nature and National Geographic. And he wrote this book called Song of the Dodo about the history of evolution. Well, that's like one of the best books I've read in years.
Wow.
I mean, why is that? You know, one, he's a really good writer. And mm-hmm. for some reason, I think it works on this other part of my brain that doesn't confuse my fiction writing, you know, but it
right.
doesn't. But the flip side of that is I read so little fiction. It's annoying. I mean, it really is. It's just terrible.
Yeah, I've noticed that trend lately myself, but I think it's more, I don't know, when you spend all of your time trying to, for me anyways, trying to write something, there's that personal element, that psychology stuff that comes from fiction, which, you know, when you get right down to it, I always used to say that the worst part of the advice, write what you know, is that it can either limit you if you think all you're going to write about is what it's like to be a kid from the Midwest who can't talk to girls, or
right.
if you're going to whittle it down to its essence, which is, you know, we all know betrayal and fear, and we know that from the moment we're 6 years old. And if that's what you're going to write, you know, you've got that covered. There, and so I end up reading a lot of nonfiction as a way to bolster my capacity to interpret all of that emotion.
Yeah.
Into something more tangible. Fiction's great, but then you just end up regurgitating what somebody else interpreted that thing as.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
That doesn't work.
Right. Right. No, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way.
How did you end up publishing newspapers?
So when I got out, when I got out of college, I needed a job. I had a bunch of student loans, and you know, the only thing I felt like I was remotely qualified to do was work for a paper. I mean, I'd worked, mm-hmm. like I said before, for high school papers and the college newspaper and all that, and I was wanting to write, but I needed a job. So I got a
right.
job at a little tiny paper in small town Connecticut, and then moved to New York before I was in graduate school, and kind of worked as in the marketing side of a broadcasting company. And then was in graduate school. Then I worked for, again, had more student loans and needed a job even more living in New York, and worked right. at a small business magazine in New York. And I just got, and then what happened was I got into the business side of, which mm-hmm. is really bizarre development that I still am not used to. Because when I was, I mean, I'm 45 now, about to be 46. So when I was in New York in the mid 90s, which is so long ago, the internet was just coming along. And,
right.
and so was desktop publishing. I mean, like, so I was kind of in the middle of, and I was sort of a closet computer geek, and I kind of was able to talk to the programming people and the designer people and kind of, you know, do all that. And then the internet comes along, and I was comfortable with all that. And, mm-hmm. so I just increasingly got into the business and technology side of publishing, which has been really strange. I mean, I've enjoyed it, I guess, and
right.
we have four kids, so kind of, you know, it's helpful, but it's been strange. And the newspaper. So I started my work career. My first job out of college was a reporter at mm-hmm. a paper, and then my then I worked in magazines and web and city magazines and so on for many years. And then I started the newspaper 10 years ago here in Memphis. And so that's how it happened. I mean, but it's been far less purposeful than I would have thought. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess it helps wandering around New York to end up that way.
Yeah.
yeah. You know, that's the other thing. So you had, while you were doing all of that, you were also doing the graduate school and writing the stories that would eventually become Something Pretty, right?
Yeah. So I was right. So I was in New York writing these stories about Tacoma and Alaska and then kind of folding those into this big, messy, awful book that was my thesis at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And then I never saw the light of day. It was really horrible. And I mean, there were good parts. Like I always liked these Tacoma stories that were sort of right there, but there's all this other nonsense with it. Again, I was trying to write this sort of postmodern thing of this guy thinking back on Tacoma and this, mm-hmm. and it was too complicated. So then I went on and wrote, you know, I really don't like writing short stories. I mean, I will write short stories, but
oh yeah, I understand.
I don't think there's anything wrong with short stories. It's just me, you know. So then I wrote another manuscript. Moved to Memphis by then, and had an agent, and then another. And so Shimmer was actually the fourth manuscript that I finished. I'd gone through the one that just thankfully never saw the light of the day. One I had an agent, got real close, didn't happen. Follow up to that. Didn't happen, bounced through agents, had terrible agents experience, then wrote Shimmer, and then that thing got shot for years before, and I went through two or three different agents on that book before it ended up, you know, at Unbridled. So I can't remember what you're asking me, but anyway, it was just, whenever I start thinking about that whole nightmare, it just...
Yeah, yeah. Are you with a good agent now?
I am unagented, which is sort of great. I mean, on some level, because I've had five or six agents over the years. Mm-hmm. First agent I had was very good, a guy named Noah Loopman, and it just didn't work out, but he was great. And it wasn't, I mean, he did a really good job, and we just didn't agree on the second book. And so we kind of politely parted company. Then I went through a series of really big name horror agents it was just horrendous. And I mean, it was so bad. And then
anybody that I should be aware of, so I don't send a query to them.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. They're really horrible business. Because then once I got to the agent I had, who was my fifth agent, I think it is, was Gary Height, a great guy who had this book, Something Pretty. Mm-hmm. Tried to sell, couldn't. But then said, hey, I know you said you've got other manuscripts. Let me take a look at one. He read Shimmer. We made some changes, and he took it and got it. I mean, he stuck with me and worked hard for 2-3 years.
Right.
The problem for agents is, I mean, you know what writers make. It's nothing. And so
absolutely.
For literary fiction. So your agent's making 15% of nothing, and they're working their asses off if they're any good. And so, you know, Gary we just went back and forth, and, you know, he didn't really want to end the relationship necessarily. It seems like I got divorced or something, but I said, you know, I want to focus on these books, and he kind of wanted me to focus on this, and we just sort of politely broke up because, you know, it's just, it's a terrible business. I mean, book publishing for the writers, for the agents, for everybody.
Oh, no.
So I'm an agent. I'd sent this when we kind of parted company. I had all these manuscripts I'm talking about, and I started sending them out to small publishers who didn't care about agents, and got this one picked up really quickly by this little publisher, but it worked out. So,
and, who was it that you worked with at Unbridled? Was it Greg or Fred?
Greg. I mean, I met Fred, but I was a Greg guy. And I would love to get, you know, I mean, we couldn't work out a second book, and I never sent them this one. I have no idea why. I mean, Greg maybe would have liked it, but anyway, it was just silly. But you know, I don't know. Maybe someday we'll find. I will send them another manuscript someday. I mean, they were really very good to me. So
yeah. Oh, I think I went through 50 agents trying to get representation. It was horrible.
Yeah.
I would get you know, comments back like, present tense literary fiction doesn't really sell. And then I would, I would go to the bookstore and look at the new release shelf, and there would be at least a dozen books that were written almost entirely or mostly in present tense.
Fantastic.
It's like, really? Yeah.
That's awesome. That's one of the greatest comments I've ever heard.
You know, and then one agent said, the writing has a haunting lyrical quality, but I don't know how to sell it. And I was like, try that haunting lyrical quality. That seems to work.
That's so funny. It's just pitiful.
Oh, another agent, you know, was like, wanted some revisions, and I said, yeah, you know, I could do that. Worked up a little bit for her, sent it back to her, got a response. And somewhere in these two responses, I received a letter talking about my book, but the two line was, "Dear Amy," and she wanted to turn, you know, The Evolution of Shadows into kind of like the Da Vinci Code in Bosnia.
Nice. And I was like, yes, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. I said no thanks.
Subgenre.
Right.
Yeah.
And
it's awful. It's just awful. I mean, I hate it. And I hate that whole side of it. And I've gone years sometimes where I've done nothing about publishing. I mean, just so sick of it and offended by it. And then I right now, I'm in this unagented phase, which was great and worked out with this book. And hopefully we'll do another book together with Outpost. Right. But, you know, I probably have to get an agent again at some point, find somebody. And it's just a terrible, it's a terrible profession. I mean, it's a terrible industry. And part of it is, I am sympathetic to, because one, the agents, but people outside the industry don't, they kind of think of Stephen King and they think of John Grisham and they think of mentioning these big numbers, but that's just, such the exception. So again, the writers aren't making any money. The agents are making 15% of no money. Publishers are under all this financial pressure.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole thing is dysfunctional. And then fundamentally, it takes a really long time to read a book and assess it. And so as annoyed as I am and just horrified by these quick comments that these people give and these stereotypical, I have a certain sense of sympathy that you can only read so many books. Excuse me. I mean, I did it for 6 months. I was an editorial assistant. I was an intern at Soho Press, a big, really, really
good,
big independent, whatever you want to call it, in New York. And when I was at Columbia, and I would read, I would go through 20 to 40 manuscripts a day.
Wow.
And it was just awful.
Yeah.
And I felt bad because I was writing at the time, and I was like, gosh, I hope nobody does this to me. But at the same time, 95% of what came in was unreadable. I'm not talking about issues with taste. I just mean objective as you can get about writing, objectively horrible. And it kind of just desensitizes you and numbs you. And so I do, despite it all, I have a certain sympathy for how difficult the whole process of assessing and publishing is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've done a couple of little DIY literary journals, and the first one was the project for a new mythology, and would get, random submissions in for that. And I was so disillusioned just with that little small, sliver of it that when these guys talked me into trying to restart it, and we got this Eunoia Solstice thing off the ground, which this podcast is a part of, I said, let's do a closed, submission policy, and let's only publish stuff that we invite people to submit. That way we can, keep some quality control on it and not have to waste our time going through a slush pile.
But then you feel sort of guilty on a certain level, like you were violating, some principle. And I mean, it's a really conflicted situation.
That's probably why it's taken us so long to get anything off the ground aside from the podcast and the website. But who knows? So it's just, where do you stand on the whole Amazon situation? Because, you know, there's with the way that the publishing industry is, you know, with this, with the book, traditional book publishers struggling, struggling mostly against Amazon, struggling against the lack of interest that readers have apparently these days, and the finances and everything like that. It's, I find it tough sometimes to be, you know, rah-rah traditional publisher because they've adopted the celebrity model, which closes out the small guys like us. And but then you go to Amazon, and the small guys like us aren't going to have any success with that either, because we don't write a book a year that's fits into an easily categorical categorized genre like, you know, paranormal vampire romance. You know.
I think I don't I think you captured a lot of, I mean, the my feeling about it. I mean, you know, I don't, I think the difference between a corporate-owned comp, you know, which at least at one point in time maybe still is, you know, the premier literary publisher, and Amazon is very small. You know, they're both big corporate, self-interested entities who aren't, I think, like you said, they're celebrity-driven. I don't think they're particularly good. You can make some of the same arguments about comp that you can make about Amazon or Random House or whoever you want to say at the top of that pyramid. So I think that, you know, this idea that the Amazon was so bad for these publishers, I don't know, they've been pretty bad for themselves. I do get, you know, I hate that local bookstores, I think maybe this, I'm making this up as I say, so
That's all right.
don't hold me to it.
I do that all the time.
I think that I don't have very much sympathy for big corporate publishers, and if Amazon hurts them, too bad. I have more sympathy for, a lot more for local bookstores.
Oh,
And I think
yeah.
that, you know, because that's a bad thing. And we're lucky in Memphis, we've got this great, we sort of survived the Great Purge of local bookstores, and we have this really nice, and it's kind of a restaurant, and there's a gift shop, and there's a great toy section, and it's a store that has books. And but you know, I read there, and I mean, it's great, you know. And
What's the store name?
it's now called the Booksellers at Laurelwood. It used to be Davis Kidd, and it was part of
Okay.
the Joseph Beth chain.
Oh, okay,
Memphis,
right.
you might have, yeah. I mean, there were what, 8 or 10 of those, and almost all of them closed in the recession and in the sort of, you know, cutbacks and so on. But I think that is unfortunate. The Amazon effect on those stores is really bad, and their ability to undermine price and so on. But I, you know, but here's the other side. So as a writer, I mean, you know, like Amazon is really actually pretty works with writers in a way that, you know, Barnes and Noble or even, I mean, you know, if I try to go into some store and or try to get, you know, I mean, I've had disastrous experiences in independent bookstores. And but Amazon, I can go on there, I can post my reviews, I can put a video up, I can do a little bio, you know, they have no problem, you know, my book's here, and they'll link to my page and anthology I had a story in. I mean, they're pretty accommodating and encouraging of, and they have some nice tools for writers. So I don't know how, I mean, I do appreciate that they do that. I mean, in a way that Barnes and Noble never did on their site, and Borders never did, and because Borders was still around when Schiller was published, I couldn't really like you know, I couldn't put anything on my page for the book or for the author. But Amazon's really accommodating of that, and I feel guilty, but I do appreciate it, you know.
And then they have their grant program for small presses that do like translation and stuff like that. You know, it's and but you know, they turn around like what they did with Macmillan a few years ago when Macmillan balked at their pricing arrangement and they shut them out. You know,
Right. I
it's
mean,
like
they're all about the money. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, they are all about the money. I think it'd be kind of interesting too, see what they do with Goodreads. I mean, I'm only from a or from a trying to sell books point of view. I don't use Goodreads a lot as a reader, I have to say, but not that I don't like it, I just don't. But they've been really kind of good to work with as a small writer of, you know, independent press writer. And now that they own Goodreads. I'm kind of curious how that goes. Because yeah. I saw one of the guys, I mean, you know, the other interesting thing, I think, is the death of book reviews in newspapers.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
And I was at a forum in New York a year and a half ago at CLMP, Council of Literary, whatever that is, Literary mm-hmm. Magazines and Presses. And there were some big agents or whatever, big-time agents, and then various people, and one guy from Amazon, and he was from the new, at that time, this must have been 2 years ago, it was the new publishing division, their own branded books, you know, and they were all, people were asking about the death of reviews, and they all said, the dirty truth is that reviews never worked in terms of selling right. books. I didn't know that. I mean, and they all said, it was great, but they never worked. Even a good review in the New York Times, it would get people excited and it would stroke a lot of egos, but it didn't mm-hmm. necessarily sell books. What sells books is word of mouth.
Right.
So things like Goodreads and Facebook and user reviews and Amazon, they've all said from the various...
The independent bookseller.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And that's the other one, and I think that does suck because you would get independent booksellers who would... And Unbridled does a really good job with that, of getting independent books yeah. excited and to hand sell, as they say. So anyway, yeah. I got off on a tangent there.
Oh, no, that's the kind of tangent that I always tend to go off on. You know, there's a really great independent bookstore here in Wichita, Watermark Books. They've been around for close to 35 years or so now. And, you know, Wichita's and the metro area has only got about 500,000 people, maybe 600,000 people. And little old Watermark, this independent bookstore, survived the rise of the mega chains. There were yep. at one point two Barnes & Noble stores and two Borders stores in Wichita. And, you know, and then Borders went out of business and Barnes & Noble closed one of their stores and Watermark has survived them all
yeah.
and survived the recessions. And it's a tough little shop and I love it. I worked there for a while, met my girlfriend working there. Well, ex-girlfriend as of this week.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, that's the way kind of life goes sometimes, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, if it hadn't been for Watermark, my local independent that I made friends with, I would not have had any book events.
Yeah.
Because you know, as much as Unbridled tried, and I know they tried, Caitlin, you know, busted her butt on that. You know, Watermark was the only one that
right.
said, "Yeah, we'll have an event."
Yeah. Well, that's the dirty secret too, is that you know people are always struck by this when I say it at an event. That events don't work, you know, they mm-hmm. really, I mean, I like doing them. I like doing them a lot. And you know, I did, I don't know, six or seven things for this last book, which really surprised me that I pulled together that many, but they don't work. I mean, if you do the math on it, I mean, that's, you just, yeah. like, just look around, you know, I mean, we had an event at in Tacoma or maybe it was up in Seattle and there were, you know, 30, 35 people. It was pretty good. A lot of strangers. It wasn't just like mm-hmm. the whole family there and all that. And I was saying to somebody, I was like, yeah, they don't work. I mean, do the math. Think about what I made tonight. Think about the bookstore made tonight. Think about the publisher made tonight. And think about what it cost for me to get here and do this. It doesn't right. work. I mean, you know, but I like doing them because I do like, it's just a boost, not just to my ego, I suppose it's that too, but it's also right. just a boost of, you know, feedback and that kind of, that it's worth it to me to, you know, to spend some money to travel to those sorts of places. But it's,
well, it fosters those personal connections. You know, you
yeah,
show up, you,
right.
you shake a few hands, you impress that audience,
right.
you know, be a decent human being, and they go off and tell their friends who weren't there and maybe somebody buys the book. It's
right.
part of that word of mouth thing. That's
yeah.
really where the reward comes in.
Right. Right.
I mean, there's that whole mythology story about John Grisham that, you know, he, you know, what launched his career was making the rounds to Mississippi bookstores just again and again and again and again. And, you know, they all supported him incredibly well. And now those are the only stores he ever reads at.
Yeah, he does it. I mean, there's this little tiny bookstore, really mostly a used bookstore here called Burke's that mm-hmm. supported him in that first book. And he still, they get advanced copies of his books. He comes
right.
and signs, he reads. There's one up in Arkansas called that bookstore in Blytheville. and there's one in the middle of nowhere, Mississippi, called mm-hmm. Turn Row Books in Greenwood, Mississippi. It's just a strange, I love Mississippi because it's so weird. And and it is the weirdest place. And yeah. But he's still, when his book come out, he goes there, does a big reading, and he, you know, I mean, give him credit. I mean, he really has
sort of
honored and continued to honor those people.
Yeah, that's impressive. I'm not a big fan of his writing, but he's been, you know, impressively loyal to the independent bookstore,
yeah.
you know, and all props to that. I mean, wonder what he'll do to, you know, help the greater community. I don't know what he's doing in that regards. We're getting close to the end here. Yeah. So before I let you go, I have a couple of things. If they haven't already slipped my mind. What are you working on now?
Working on a novel about I'm so bad at describing stuff when I'm done. It's relentlessly humorless, I'll say that. And, it is about a narrator living in an abandoned city. So mm-hmm. we'll put it there. And then just this life he lives in this essentially abandoned city. It's not Detroit. It's not
right.
New Orleans, but it's somewhere like that. I started on that almost 2 years ago. Took a break when Something Pretty, you know, I had to take about a 6 month break with everything with Something Pretty. And so I'm back to that. I'm hoping I'll finish that in sometime this spring. Mm-hmm. And then I'm one of the other books. I mean, again, everything's out of order for me. I'm hopeful that Outpost 19, which did Something Pretty, will do this other book about a reporter covering a series of arsons in Alaska, in Connecticut. And,
cool.
And that one's kind of semi-funny, actually. So we'll see.
Well, good luck. Good luck with those. Last question is that one of the things that I've been talking to a lot of writers, some of them not for this podcast, for an independent weekly alternative paper here in town that I wrote for a while. And one of the things I noticed talking to them was that some of them had this perception that they want to just be insular at the college, do their writing there, and not really be involved with outreach to the community and be engaged with the public in any way.
Yeah.
And one of the issues that I'm always concerned about is what can we as writers do outside of just writing the next book and making them, you know, readable, entertaining, you know, significant and meaningful.
Yeah.
What can we do to engage and encourage readers? Because if we don't go out and actively do something to encourage readers, we're shooting ourselves in the foot as far as a viable future in this thing. So and I have a few ideas about things we could be doing, you know, more addressing the notion of story as something that is part of our evolutionary necessity. You know, we are a storytelling animal. It's what keeps us, it's how we store and transmit culture. So it has some significance beyond just entertainment. But what are some of the things you think you might help us get out there and get those would-be non-readers to maybe once in a while pick up a book?
Yeah, you're right about that. And I am guilty of doing not enough. And I've sort of tried to make up more of an effort, starting with Shimmer, I mean, because I had a mm-hmm. book then, so it's a little easier, but and with this also to do everything from, you know, more events at the library and, you know, just engage with the writing community in a way that doesn't come easily to me. I tend to be sort of, I want to just write in my dark office and I want to send my book out and I want to get it published. I don't want to engage in the writing community for some reason. And I don't know what, you know, maybe it's, and I don't think that's productive because I think what you're saying is what I should do and others should do. So I think it's hard because maybe to be a writer, I mean, so many people who write are very introverted or kind of insular. Mm-hmm. It's kind of part of the package. And so those things don't come easily. And I think, I don't have a good answer for you other than I think you're right that I and others should do more. And I've sort of slowly gotten better about engaging with more of the writing community here in Memphis. But I wish I had a better answer for you, you know, because it's also stupid from a from a practical point of view. Yeah. And I look back and all the stupid things I've done in terms of my writing career, the career side of it, the networking side, on a purely practical level, you want to be out there meeting people because you never know where that person might go,
right,
how they might help you. And that seems unseemly to say it, but that's just the way it tends to work. And I've been very dumb about that, you know? Yeah. So I don't have a good answer for you.
Oh, the other side of being engaged is that you never know when you might be able to help someone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, both of them are great, getting the help, which I've never been very good at doing, is getting help. But, and, you know, various things I've done, I've always noticed that my luck turns around a little bit more when I get out there and do what little I can to, you know, to help somebody else out. You know, started the project for New Mythology, and pretty quick, you know, got some interest from Unbridled for the first book, and now that I'm doing this, I'm talking to other writers, actually feel connected to a community again, which was hard to do in Wichita because there's no community here, really,
yeah,
to speak of.
Yeah.
But it's tough.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we'll stay in touch.
Yeah. Thank you very much for doing this and for asking me. I really appreciate it.
No problem. It was good to talk to you. I'm glad I got to pick your brain a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I like I said, I really did enjoy Shimmer, and I'm enjoying Something Pretty as I get through it, which is why I wanted to talk to you, of course. So thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right. There you have it. My conversation with Eric Barnes. Hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, the Outrider podcast is taking a little break until March 24th, so I will be back and talk in your general direction come March 24th. Take care, and wish me luck on my big transition. Bye.